Well, hi everyone, Pastor Brian here with you with another installment of our first ever summer interview series. I hope you've enjoyed the conversations that we've had so far, and I'm very excited to be joined today by Parfait Basile. He is the author of the recent book, The Way of Befriending, Transforming Relationships and Organizations for Belonging from InterVarsity Press. And I just read this book this last week. I loved it, reached out to Parfait, and he was gracious enough to come on and have a conversation with me. So Parfait, thanks so much for taking some time.
Well, thank you, Brian, for having me on your platform. Very excited about this.
Right on. It's an honor. I'd like to start with just a little bit of your story. You share about it in the book, but how did your story create this passion for you for befriending and belonging?
Yeah, high level. You know, as your audience probably will start picking up the more I talk, there's an accent in my voice. So I am an immigrant. And the story of displacement and movement has forever been there as part of my story. So I was 2 years old when my parents took my siblings and I, and we started moving along the West African region because my dad used to work for an overseas organization. And so by virtue of that, those movements, very similar to military children, it really created an element of an ache, if you will, of wanting to figure out where's home, and where do I belong. And so that really has shaped a lot of my my formative years. And part of that ended up kind of driving me towards faith as well, right? Because I was often reminded that I was the outsider looking in, and I was looking for unconditional love and unconditional acceptance, and the proposition of the Christian tradition and the Christian faith really resonated with me very early on. And then with that, this idea of God befriending humanity and befriending people and loving us no matter who we are really resonated. And then just meeting a wide range of people throughout my journey, and as I navigated new spaces, new cultures, and people with different faith traditions, different socioeconomic backgrounds, you name it, and having great relationships at time, and other times our differences being the basis for which I was not accepted, right? And so seeing that theme all throughout my travels outside of the American context in Africa, and then moving to the United States and seeing similar things, but the difference here, the basis of difference was like race or political affiliation. I saw similar threads, but same virus, if I might call it, the notion of othering. And so that got me very passionate very early on, and how can I, my storyline, my faith be part of the solution and helping people realize that we do this to one another, we other each other, and let's find a way to move towards each other the same way God moves towards us. And so high level, that's kind of how I got to doing what I do today, based on my storyline.
I love it. And we'll talk more about othering here in just a minute. But the structure of this book was really interesting. In fact, I can safely say, I read all the time. I can safely say I've never read a book quite like it, in that you tell stories, you make arguments, you cite research, you have all these kind of reflection questions, but you also include a lot of your own music. I found myself scanning QR codes to watch music videos throughout the book, or times where I wasn't able to do that, I'm at least reading lyrics. The whole thing is very much this kind of multimedia experience. Would love to hear a little bit about what led you to structure the book in that way.
Yeah, no, you nailed it. It was a multimedia experience, and I was so grateful that my publisher, InterVarsity Press, was willing to have fun with it and got the vision and went in that direction. Simply put, Brian, I wanted to write a book that was an honest reflection of myself and the very content that I was inviting the readers into, which is this idea of courage, vulnerability, as we attempt to connect with one another and get to know others, right? It's really hard to know folks if we don't know the full story, or if we create barriers for them to show up as they are and as they're uniquely made. And so for me, ever since I can remember, music has always played a big part of my identity and how I made sense of the world and how I processed experiences in the world. You know, so as I was talking about earlier, being the outsider looking in, you know, by virtue of moving from one place to another, you know, the first ways in which I made sense of it and processed the pain and my emotions was through writing songs. And so I would write music all the time. And over the years, as I would share these songs to people, even though the experiences were distinct and different, people would resonate with the essence of the songs, and they could find their storylines somehow interwoven in my songs. And so it felt like telling my story, without telling, singing songs and referring to some of the lyrics that came from those experiences would not be doing justice to the reader. So there was a need of incorporating that as part of the manuscript. And that's also a reflection of how I do my work as a consultant and working with organizations. I always incorporate music as part of it because music has a way of speaking to us in ways that words alone may not, right? Because it evokes, it speaks to the senses. So it was, again, it was a way of being honest and being transparent and incorporating all my giftings into the book.
Well, and art creates, again, just such it's so much more emotive than words on a page. Words on a page are beautiful, but I found myself struck by, I would read your lyrics and I would think, wow, these are great. And then I would listen to you sing them, and I your heart come obviously your heart is going to come through a live performance far more than words on a page, and that really helped the message of what I think you were trying to communicate through some of these songs really hit home for me.
You know, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, it was a really nice addition when the publisher really thought about let's use the QR codes, you know, leverage technology to be able to bring that emotional piece to the words.
Yeah, it was great. Now, getting into the content of the book a little bit, it's obviously about befriending. What are some of the forces in our world that you see that are getting in the way of friendship and belonging? And maybe what are some ways we can start to overcome some of these things?
Yeah, well, talking about forces, they're all over. You know,
Yeah, there's a lot.
there's a lot. You know, maybe a couple that we can zero in on. But before I even answer specifically that question, I think it's important to maybe couch how I came about writing the book. Right, there was an impetus to this, and you know, two pieces. Number one, it's important to highlight. You know, the data point that really hit me hard, Brian, was when I found out that one in three adults in the United States is reporting feeling an experience of loneliness. And every other youth as well is reporting experiencing loneliness. And the data tells us that those experiences of loneliness are directly correlated to adverse health outcomes, you know, leading all the way to shorter life expectancy. And so then there were a lot of conversations around why people are feeling lonely, right? And the finger was being pointed, right? At it's that group, it's the other, it's those folks, or it's technology, and it's the algorithms and social media, you name it. There was all this finger pointing, and there's validity to a lot of those. But the crux of the matter, from my experience and the work that I have been doing over the years, pointed me to an elephant in the room that nobody was naming. And it was this reality that we have lost the art or the ability to be in relationship with people who are different from us or who we disagree with. And so that compelled me to really say, okay, how do we engage the audience around this? How do we stay in relationship with people who are different from us? How do we move towards those who are different from us? And then coupled with this thing where when I think back to my own experience as an immigrant and the places where I actually felt like I belonged or a sense of home was within unexpected friendships. In some ways, there was something about unexpected friendships that catalyzed or crystallized the theology of God befriending me, right? It was through people that I experienced God's unconditional love in unexpected places, right? And so those two things in tandem really led to me really kind of thinking about, okay, I need to write this book. Now, back to your question quickly, some of the barriers are cultural barriers, right? The messaging we've heard about the other, that group, And so our fears, our prejudices, and our own stories of trauma and hurt, right?
Yeah.
And then we have less obvious ones, what I like to, especially in the American context, I would say, the good things that turn into idols, right? Our jobs,
yeah,
or our insular family structures, you know, my people, just my nuclear folks, you know, again, love my people, love my family, but sometimes we can kind of erect them to a point where there's no more bandwidth, no more capacity for anyone else and others, right? And so, yeah, those would be two things that I would name as barriers.
Yeah, those are huge ones. I have a little bit of a theory, and I want to try it out on you, and you can tell me if you think I'm on the right track or not. But I think about, you know, media. We obviously are able to sort of find media sources that fit our narrow framework, right, and reinforce our own beliefs and create suspicion of other people. But then I think about social media, and obviously we're exposed to all sorts of toxicity in social media spaces. But I think even on the personal level, I've just reflected on this a lot, how due to social media, it's possible for me to learn an acquaintance's views on all sorts of controversial topics, views I may not have found out about for years, if at all. And so what's happening is it's easy for me to then develop an opinion or a thought or, oh, I don't know if we're going to get along or not based on hearing all these controversial views, because that's social media creates a platform for that. Whereas if I was just meeting someone in person apart from social media, it would be easier to connect on a human level without instantly going to, well, what do you think about immigration or, you know, some other controversial topic. Now, I realize part of that is incumbent upon me to not be overly judgmental of right. somebody in the expression of their views. But I just can't help but wonder, this sort of overexposure we have to one another's controversial opinions, I just can't think that that's helpful. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think you're onto something, right? It's almost like the first introductory touch point is a visceral thing, right? Something that is extremely, you know, something that we feel a strong reaction to, and that's not going to help. It doesn't allow for that, you know, progression or incremental process of discovery, right, which is usually part of the social bonding and social interactions between people. So I think, you know, one way that I've been thinking about is the disappearance of third spaces, places of encounter, places of discovery. And social scientist Putman, you know, has, it's, you know, written a lot about that. You know, he's the author of the book Bowling Alone. And this, you know, I was having a conversation, it was just last week, with my wife and some friends. We were talking about our encounter story, you know, 20 plus years ago. And we were talking about how we met at the computer lab at a university.
Yeah.
And to which our friends were telling us, because they have kids who are college age now, and they were saying, I don't think they have computer labs anymore. And I was shocked. I was like, wait a second.
Yeah.
University experience without a computer lab? That was just kind of like the thing back in the days. And they were pretty much arguing that, you know, now students can just send the digital copy of the assignment, right? So the again, there's probably places to print, but the prevalence of it is, you know, is disappearing. And so those third spaces where people can encounter and actually get to meet each other and have those conversations where you can establish commonality first or points of connection and not just what we disagree on, I think, you know, it plays a role in where we find ourselves today.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And I think we're seeing the need societally to recover some of that, right? To what does it look like to reimagine third spaces? Yeah, maybe a computer lab is unnecessary, but what does it look like to create those spaces where chance encounters and random encounters are possible? It's definitely necessary. Now, we've talked about this a little bit already, but early in the book, you talk about the problem of othering. Now, for those who are unfamiliar with the term, what is othering and why is it so problematic?
Yeah, so othering is, I like to describe it this way. It can come unexpectedly, or it can be something that's hardened in our meaning-making schema, if you will. I like to say, I'm having a conversation with you right now, and we're in the process of social discovery, and then you share something, and then I'm like, wait a second. Really? I cannot believe you think this way, right? And all of a sudden, you shift it from moving from just a relatable, decent human being to potentially a less than human being, right? And so it's when we, from a psychological standpoint, and I think there's a spiritual element to it, we're starting to kind of dehumanize you. You're becoming less than this ideal image bearer, if you will, of God. And I'm like, how could you? That's beneath the bare minimum. And so there's different things that trigger that. It can be, your belief system, and for some of us, it can be things like your faith tradition or life decisions you've made or your race. Again, depending on what has fed into that characterization. And so we do that, and we've done this as long as we've been humans, right? Through tribal thinking. And one of the things that I share in the book is that even though if back in the days maybe it had a utilitarian purpose whereby you needed to know who your tribe was, because otherwise, it's for survival purposes, it was important. More and more in modern society, that is not super helpful. If anything, I'm arguing that it's getting in the way of connection. Which is directly tied to our own sense of belonging. And so, yeah, so I unpack our understanding around othering. What causes that? What are the various reasons why we lean into othering? Because understanding the mechanics of it can allow us to maybe see it coming and see it at play so that we can, mitigate for that. But yeah, that's the idea of othering.
And just that awareness of our own tendency to do it, I think is really, really important. That I might recognize in myself, oh, this could be something I might be prone to do with somebody who thinks a certain way or acts a certain way. And those are uncomfortable things to realize about yourself, but I think we subconsciously end up othering if we're not aware of our own tendency to do it. Is that right?
It is, and that's one thing that I try to do in the book is really just share examples and stories of times when I'm the one doing the othering, right? And I know you got a chance to read the book and your audience is not yet, but I tell the story of ways in which as an African immigrant, I had othered the Black American community without realizing that I had been socialized and conditioned through the media that was being exported thousands of miles away. I talk about how watching music videos, rap, hip hop music videos and movies really projected not only a positive image of the African American community for me, a young African growing up, in terms of their charisma, their sense of style and creativity, but at the same time, I was internalizing messages of them being dangerous and a sense of threat. And I came to face that, with a story in the book where I was going to get a haircut in a predominantly, Black neighborhood. And so I had othered them without realizing that it was there. And so we all have a propensity towards that.
That was a really powerful reflection on your part, and I just think highly, highly relatable on a number of different levels. Now, something you said that really struck me, you're talking about Jesus, and you say that part of what draws you to him is his relational leadership, which I would completely agree with that. But what do you mean by that phrase to say that Jesus is a highly skilled relational leader?
Yeah, Jesus, man. I just want to hang out with the guy, you know what I'm saying? It was just ahead of its time in many ways. A few things come to mind for me. So, I talk about this in the book, how when we look at the ecosystem in those days, right? The political dynamics, the social dynamics, we tend to lose sight of what were some of the things at play then, right? When you think about the disciples, they were not just, happy go camper folks who just got along and saw the world the same way. I mean, you had some serious conflicts at play. You think about Matthew, who was a tax collector. And so in that historical context, that means he was in bed with the oppressor, with the Roman Empire, right? He was doing their business, you know, stealing from his people and you know, robbing them from their hard-earned money, right, and giving it back to the oppressor. So he was in partnership with them. And then you have the zealot, you know, who was part of a sect, who was their main tenets was what, you know, the violent, you know, overthrow of Roman rule, right? So imagine just the dynamics in that room. Here's someone who's literally a traitor, and the other one's like, why are we even interacting with the oppressor? And Jesus says, come and follow me, and we're going to do life together. And guess what? The extent to which y'all will be successful in carrying on the torch will be based on how much y'all love each other.
Yeah.
Wow. Again, those are just two examples. You know, you had some of them who were hot-tempered. Some of them were more analytical. And Jesus, again, with the gender dynamics at that time, you know, again, though we know that Mary Magdalene was not like a disciple per se, like among the 12, right? But there's this belief that she was just part of the crew following them and journeying with them as, you know, a patron. And so there was some social expectations that were really broken in that context. And Jesus was just like, listen, I'm about befriending. I'm transcendent. I'm looking beyond your tribes. You know, yeah. What we've called those lines, I want us to really bridge across those lines. And so he models something for us there, I think, that if we really take his approach seriously, that calls us to a deeper and higher aspiration, if you will. And so that's what I mean by it. He wasn't confined by the norms and the practices of those times. He was driven by a love and a desire for relational proximity that transforms more so than conformity to the way things have been. That's what I really speak to when I talk about his relational leadership.
It's easy to miss, I think, on a surface reading of the text, all of those relational dynamics at play. But you're right, there's differing ideologies that we have, you know, men and women. There's just so much going on there. Any sort of picture of the disciples is this sort of monolithic group where they all kind of thought the same and were all into Jesus. Like, that's just not true. There was such diversity. And you're right, he was such a skilled relational leader. And you're right, an incredible example for us in that regard, and someone we can learn from as we try to kind of hold space for and build community with diverse people groups, right?
Yeah. And even more telling, I mean, not more telling, but, you know, just to add to that mix, you know, Judas, who ends up right betraying him, you know, which that one is close to the heart, right? He knew what may transpire, but yet say, you're still going to journey with me, right? Yeah. We probably disagree on what your understanding is, what my ministry is supposed to be, but let's still journey together, right?
There was a concept in the book that I've never heard this concept named before, but as soon as you started talking about it, I resonated with it very deeply, and that was the idea of a belonging wound, that as we are seeking to befriend or seeking to create belonging, that we all come to those situations with a belonging wound. Can you talk about, first of all, what is that? What is a belonging wound?
Yeah. Even me just hearing you ask this question just, you know, takes me back to that place as I was processing and writing this part of the book. You know, there's this story I tell in the book about an encounter at a conference with this unexpected friend who, you know, not to ruin it for the listener here, but he just unexpectedly notices me in a crowded room, and just with a gesture of welcome and invitation, you know, literally expresses to me that he saw me, he noticed me, and that I mattered. And by so doing, just through that gesture and that act, really spoke deeply to a hurt, a deep scar, wound in me around, does anyone see me? Do I matter? Yeah. Am I noticed? right? And so when I tell this story in a lot of my presentation, you know, the story leads to different, you know, what I call situational roles to belonging that we all can play based on the situation or what have you. But then when I ask the audience, you know, which character or which role do you most identify with? Without fail, time and time again, most people identify with the what I call the outsider role, the role of someone on the outside looking in. And then now the basis upon which someone feels like an outsider differs, right, from one person to another. But that shared experience of feeling like I'm an outsider and that I don't belong, we've all experienced some of that. And if there's three core questions that really are, that are a basis of those wounds, and number one is, can I trust you, right? And folks have experienced an instance in a life story where, you know, they were betrayed or they didn't feel like they could trust someone. So betrayal is something that we share. The second one is, do I matter to you, right? So folks have experienced feeling insignificant or dispensable, right? And then the third one is, the question is, do my concerns or my needs matter too, you know? And people have experienced this for the most part in places where they feel like, you know, you just show up, you just be an ornament on the wall, but your voice, we don't really care about it. And so when you look at those things, you know, usually when I talk about belonging wounds, they're along the lines of those questions and the hurt stories we've had around that. And I believe we all carry them, and they become actually opportunities for us to extend empathy to one another and see that there's a shared place we can start from.
I thought it was particularly interesting what you just said about most people when it comes to different belonging wounds, the one we identify with the most is the outsider. And I would say that's certainly the case for me, because I think part of the insidious nature of the outsider wound is we think we're the only one who has it and that everyone else is on the inside. Is that right?
That's fair. That's fair. And that's such a powerful activity when I do it meetings and trainings, because people are like, what? You too? Right? There's just this visual realization that, well, I thought I was the only one, but I guess you as well. And that's the commonality. And I mean, we can go even more philosophical and say, right, it's part of the shared human suffering. You know, we and that longing to be seen, to not just be alone. And then that presents a unique opportunity for all of us to become that unexpected friend that says, I see you, to say, you matter, right? And so those are some of the arguments I try to make in the book.
Yeah, no, it's so important, and I think to have that empathy and compassion to realize I'm not the only one who feels like the outsider. Others might as well. How can I be a voice and a source of inclusion for those for others who are feeling like they're the outsider instead of just sort of waiting around waiting for someone to do that for me, right?
And there's an idea that I talk about in the book that, you know, the degree to which we remain proximate to that belonging wound can become that catalyst that makes us really want to be that unexpected friend, right? Because oftentimes, if we are so distant to what it means and what it feels like to be an outsider, then we become unintentionally apathetic or totally disconnected to what that could be like for someone. You know, some people out of trauma just totally erase it. You know, they're like, I can't remember this, I don't want to get anywhere close to that. But those who actually stay proximate but not defined by it, right, they learn from it and they remember what it feels like and they let it drive and fuel movement towards others, can be extremely transformative. And that's the invitation.
Proximate but not defined by it. I like that. All right, that's a helpful framework for me to think through that. Now, we're almost out of time here, but so maybe we'll end with this little series of questions here. You say that befriending requires three commitments: courage, curiosity, and compassion. Let's take those one at a time. Why is courage important in the act of befriending and creating belonging?
Yeah, the way I talk about it is that courage is actually two faceted, right? Just the mere fact of being willing to move towards another requires working through something, right? And working through maybe my own inhibitions, my own prejudice, my own fears, my own character flaws or challenges, right? And so there's that invitation. How can we cultivate that? And so there's an element of I call honesty as a mirror in the book. There's so the inward facing dimension of courage, which asks us to really do some introspective work and question the storylines, the trauma stories that are shaping how we then become reluctant to move towards someone. There's a lot there to unpack for all of us because we've all been socialized with some storylines about others. And some of it is legitimate because out of our own hurt and what have you, right? And then there's the courage on the piece of moving towards others who are different no matter what, right? Because there's might be a, you know, and I talk about this thing in the book where there might be a nuggets there for us that we may not even realize, like an answer to our own belonging wound that might be in that encounter that lies in front of us. But in this in especially divided time right now, the fear of what will my tribe say? You know, what how will I look if I try to understand the other people? It's really risky because then I call it you fail the purity test because, you know, are you with them or you're with us? You know, the moment you try to understand them, well, you're no longer pure enough to be part of us. So there's a social risk to that and it requires courage. And so those are the two facets that I talk about with courage in that framework.
Yeah, that's really, really good. Curiosity. I love just, I don't know, curiosity is a topic. Maybe that sounds weird, but I feel like I've invested a lot of time and energy in learning about its importance for relationships, trying to become more curious myself. Why is curiosity so important?
Oh, curiosity. I mean, I'm still a student at curiosity and doing it better, but curiosity is powerful in the sense that it's a tool, it's a mechanism through which you start discovering the other person, you get to learn, right? It's also is a very powerful communication tool that helps de-escalate situations. You know, rather than things really being escalated into more tension, you can use great questions to really diffuse, de-escalate, and show that you're really, you know, wanting to understand. Curiosity is a way to just gather new information and learn, right? And so it's a pathway for growth and it's very transformative. You know, I've talked about in the book about how much curiosity has just changed my own perspective on a lot of topics over the years as I gotten to find out things that I didn't know, right? So there's, you know, I know I'm, you know, I just released a book, but there's one book that I just gotta promote. I cannot promote that book enough. It's the book by Dr. I think J.R. Briggs.
Yeah, I just read it recently.
The Art of Asking, I think, Better Questions or something.
Oh,
What's
I think that's right. The Art of Asking Better Questions.
Better Questions? Oh my gosh, you know, it's a fantastic book. I do reference it in my own book, but it's just a great resource in what is he calls tuning up our questions. How can we ask better questions in order to have better connections with people?
Yeah, I just looked it up. That's it. The Art of Asking Better Questions, Pursuing Stronger Relationships, Healthier Leadership, and Deeper Faith. And I love that you brought that up because I found it to be so helpful as I'm around people all the time. And I just want to get better at it. I don't want to ask someone, so what's new? I want to have better questions to ask and promote more interesting conversation. And I found that book to be so helpful. And I love curiosity because it is just. It's like a fire hose to just the judgment that can often be raging in our hearts, right? When I decide I don't understand everything about you, I don't know everything about you, I want to learn. Don't know. It's just so healthy in so many different ways and so connective.
And maybe one piece to add to this is it's almost like curiosity allows us to switch from a paradigm of wanting to be right to one of wanting to understand,
Yeah, I love
right?
that.
You know, and at least for me, that helps me when I'm putting myself in a position of I just want to understand this because greater understanding would allow for deeper connection, but even more so, more effectiveness, even if my goal was to try to communicate more effectively where I want the other person to go. Not to advocate for manipulation, right? But
Sure.
certainly that pivot, okay, let me understand rather than I want to absolutely be right. Curiosity is a great tool towards that pivot.
Yeah, absolutely. And then finally, compassion. Talk to us about why that's important in the act of befriending.
Yeah, compassion plays an interesting role in that those three C's, because one, if the first two are done well, I argue and I believe deeply that it leads you to a place of compassion. Given some of the things we already talked about, how there's a shared struggle around belonging wounds.
Yeah.
Our stories are not perfect. We live in a very broken world. And so when we move into courage and then lead them with curiosity and actually hear those stories and understand them, there's something that comes out that is compassionate, right? So that's I talk about compassion really as an outcome of the first two processes. And then in the book, I talk about God's compassion actually being almost the starting place for that courage, right? How a care and love for humanity really was kind of the trigger for the very act of befriending. And there's something there for us as Christians to really emulate that model. How can a love for God's creation, God's people who are image bearers, be the starting point for how can I be courageous to move towards you and get to know you more and understand in the unique ways in which God has shaped your story.
I love that. And man, we adopt that sort of posture. Helps people feel like they belong, helps people feel cared for, it nurtures relationships, it creates health. So many benefits to that.
And it leads us to better solutions. That's the part too. We start, whether you take all the hot button issues, right? We feel so strongly that we know what needs to happen. But until we really fully understand the complexities of other people's stories and motivations, right? Once we get to that place, there's some creative and more sustainable solutions that can come out of those engagements.
No, that's absolutely right. Well, the book, once again, is The Way of Befriending, Transforming Relationships and Organizations for Belonging. We didn't even get into all the great stuff you wrote in the book about how to create belonging in organizations. So I guess people are going to have to buy it and read it. But that stuff I'm going to be going over again is, want my own organization. I think we're pretty good at this. I want us to get better. But parfait, Basile, really, really appreciate the time. Thank you for writing the book. Congratulations on it. And thank you so much for just coming and talking to me and for all the work that you're doing.
Well, thank you, Brian, for reaching out, for reading a book, and just for your ministry here with your community and wanting to continue building strong community of belonging. So I look forward to staying connected.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love that. All right. Well, thanks again. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Have a great week, and we will see you this weekend. Bye-bye. Thank you.